Welcome to Tilth Talk Radio. Today we're going to be talking fungicide on alfalfa. In our spotlight, we'll take a look at some tar spot research. Ag History Minute, we'll talk of the origins of the U.S. drought monitor. Cool Beans, That's Corny, we'll have some current events, and we'll wrap things up with a Field Good Friday. With me today are Bill Schomburg.
Hey, guys.
Todd Schomburg.
Hey to all the Tilthies out there.
And I'm Matt Brueger, all with Tilth Agronomy. So here we are in a relatively dry and sunny day, but that's not really been the case lately. It's kind of a every other day chance of rain type of thing.
Yesterday it was stocking cap and coat weather.
Yeah,
today
it was cold.
It's short sleeves and sunscreen weather.
This is like normal spring, right?
It is.
Ish. I mean, yeah. Ish, yeah. It just, the one thing with the drought was you could do stuff when you wanted.
Yeah.
And when you, I don't know, it was windy at times, but it didn't ever, you never got rained out. So now it's just been weird because it's either windy, rainy, like it's just back to how farming normally feels where you got to.
Yeah. We're still not
fight the weather
as wet as we typically would be. I don't think anyway, when you look at the rivers and stuff for this time of year, it's not, we're not back to where we were.
It is up though.
And guys, it's not again, not up like it normally would be.
But for it to catch up through this time of year is pretty interesting to watch, you know, so it's tiles are running at places and all that. So it
all depends.
It's very
really spotty. Yeah.
I've never seen two where you drive around one county, everybody's at a standstill, next county, everybody's planting. So that's
just this morning I was driving and it was like, oh, that's a lake in that field. Oh, I can see like the shimmer of water between all the furrows in the field. And then like half a mile later, there's two planters just going like crazy. And granted, where I was, there's sandy patches and heavy ground. So, I mean, it makes some sense. But, yeah. But
the rain we got on Tuesday, we got a blast at like lunchtime and then another at supper time.
Yeah.
It was really variable too, though, like who got what. And the ones that got it big time are the fields that you're seeing the shimmer yet and the ones that didn't.
Right. Like to the northeast of us and to the south of us seemed to get hammered and we were somewhere in the middle. Because I know south, there were places that were getting like 1.5 to 2.5 inches of rain this week. So
when it rains, it pours. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas we got what, probably 7/10, 6/10 somewhere
something
in there.
Like that.
So not a crazy amount. And yeah, like we said, there'd be guys that are probably going today and in some fields and others that are be waiting out the weekend, perhaps depending on what kind of weather we get there too. Because temperatures are going up, it's supposed to almost hit 80 on Sunday, but that could bring some more storms in. So
it does seem like most guys where they were able to plant or start planting, they have more of their drier fields planted.
Yeah.
So now you got like your middle or your fields that are usually wetter to go. Yeah. So that's going to be tough too. Yeah, it takes longer and be patient to get them
in. Any corn up, Todd? You probably do.
Yeah, I got some but it's weirdly anything that was planted within like for the last 4 weeks basically is all merging pretty much at the same time.
Yep. Yeah.
So it always is good. That feeling, there is something about that of when you put that seed in the ground, but then you see it coming up, it just makes you feel better. I actually do wish some of it was like a little taller where you could really row it. I feel like just this week it's that kind of, okay, there's one.
Yep, spiking.
But yeah, you want that where it's really nice and kind of a distinct row. So we'll have that next week, and that's always nice.
What's really kind of throwing a wrench in is the rye and some of that stuff's going to be ready to go this next week.
And alfalfa, holy man.
Alfalfa will be not too far behind.
First crop alfalfa harvest is going to throw a wrench into, you know, you're going to have to make that decision. Are you better off holding off planting corn, doing alfalfa, doing both? Or trying to, you know, just keep getting corn done and pushing alfalfa back a little bit. And I think to each producer, it's a decision each person's got to make depending on what they have for quality on hand and inventory and manpower. Because that is hard. Like, it's the choice of, like, do you half-ass two things or whole-ass one thing?
Yep.
And even like, Bill, compared to like when we grew up, there was equipment you used for both things. Always, you know, like, well, that's our planter tractor that goes on the, usually not the blower, but
right,
it could,
right,
on the blower or something like that. But in today's, it's a lot of tillage tractors got to be on the pile,
right,
are the same. So, you know, that's different. And just, and even I wasn't noticing guys having to make the choice of, because of equipment, that was part of it. In general, I think they got the right amount of equipment. It was the manpower,
yeah,
to be in that equipment,
right,
was going to be the tricky part, to find enough people to make sure you're not like really half-assing both things, that you can kind of do both properly.
If you half-ass, Todd, you'll get your whole ass kicked.
So. Yeah.
Yes.
You can't half-ass.
Great reason to no-till. Then you don't have to worry about having the tillage tractor on the pile.
Fair. It's hard to decide on the rye, though. The rye and the trid is probably ready. And it's like, okay, it's supposed to rain a little bit tonight and then a little bit on Sunday. It's like, well, when do you cut that?
Right. Well, it depends what quality you're looking for, too. It's kind of that game of, is the triticale for dairy quality, then you really can't mess around too much. Otherwise, it's just going to be heifer feed. And if you don't need the heifer feed, then...
I was watching a triple mower this morning, pretty much almost getting stuck in a field. It wasn't one of our growers, was just driving by, and I'm like, holy man, that looks freshly cut. And then I got to where they were cutting this real, like, standing water, just giving her through standing water.
You need to wash the blades off.
One thing I would say is, like, I don't know how close it was to getting stuck, but it did seem like at least there was a base there for it. So,
what do you think the ash content of that windrow was?
I'm wondering if they were just, that area was probably just cutting it to get it away. Not, I don't know what you're going to get a chopper in there. But probably 3/4 of the field in a couple days, you'll be able to get a chopper in.
And, sure. Yeah, it's just kind of a wild, like, I don't think it's quite as early as, like, 2012 was, because we had an early spring that year.
Yep. But we could keep going that year.
Right, but you could get stuff done. This was the weirdest spring where it feels like we were burned out before we even started.
Yeah.
It was like, well, we didn't even get started, and we're like, because February was so warm, and like you say, Matt, it just was somewhat early, and then now alfalfa's on the earlier side because that never really went dormant and kept growing. So yeah, kind of a wild field to the spring that honestly, for me, it feels like it's June and it's still fairly early May. Like, it just has the feel like of what we've been looking at and where we're at and that kind of thing. So it is
the
interesting spring.
The conversation I kind of had this morning with a guy was like, we're just going to go until we can't, because we're too fired up not like to stop.
Yeah.
And so it's, like, it feels dumb to stop, so we're just going to go and do as much as we can.
And that's planting, or that's...
That was with planting. But yeah, it is kind of like that. Normally, you know, May 10th isn't... It's not panic mode time.
The forecast makes you feel like 2 weeks could slip away. We could be sitting here in 2 weeks and going, like, shoulda, woulda, coulda, but you'd still got to make sure conditions are at least adequate. You know, yes, they may not be optimum, they may not be perfect, but
but
it's still not mudding in time.
Right, it's not worth making mistakes. And I guess that's the point I'm getting at, is like, yes, you should, if you have dry enough acres, like he was talking about going around a wet hole, it's not very big, but just going to drive around it and it'll be fine. And that's fine, but, you know, if it's half the field and you're just going to mud it in, that it's not that time yet, I don't think, even with the threat of rain. Who would have thought we'd be talking about that?
No, that snow that we got, you know, 2 months ago, that's kind of the official drought buster for our area. I mean, looking at the drought monitor, there's still some, you know, quite a bit of areas of Iowa and kind of southeast Wisconsin that are still under it, which sort of shocked me. I thought with this
Iowa's been stretch getting of rain, a lot of storms.
Yeah, I thought this week it would change, but it's definitely gotten much better there. So it's just not pulled them out of the, you know.
I imagine it's probably the same thing we're seeing here, like, somewhere is getting 2/10
and
another, their neighbors are getting of an inch, and so it's not clearing the drought monitor that way.
But in general, the whole Midwest is kind of as dry, or excuse me, it's the least this colored map has looked in a year, so it's sort of
red anymore.
Right, there's no more red, there's a couple
yellows, a couple oranges.
Yep, but nothing really, real bad.
All right. Are you guys ready to get into our topic? Mm-hmm. So fungicide on alfalfa. Do we do it? Do we not? Bill, what do you got?
Yeah, this topic was supposed to run last week, but we decided to pivot and go to our fantasy corn league draft. So it was a little less of a timing issue than I had hoped, but it's still applicable. I think, you know, it's probably past now. We're past that time of getting it sprayed, but we can still talk about it. It's a tough one because I don't think we see a super lot of yield results from doing it. It's not like you spray it and you get 2 tons of dry matter more. It just doesn't work like that. I think every year is different. I think getting when you can get out there and spray every year is different. And I've seen it really work well when we spray it and then we get cold weather. The trials don't support that it does handle colder weather, but I just think it helps it. But then again, we get a lot of rain, extended cutting windows, you know, that's kind of where some of it shines. So
yeah.
What diseases are out there? The main ones that we're spraying for in our neck of the woods is common leaf spot, lepto leaf spot, spring black stem, and then a couple other leaf spots. So it's basically duh. It's leaf and stem diseases, right? That's what's there.
That's all alfalfa is leaves and stems.
Exactly. Yep. We're not protecting an ear or a husk or silks or anything like that. It's just leaves and a stem. So that's what we're trying to protect. And I think the biggest thing that I've seen is first crop is the one you should target if you're going to do any. It's the one that stands out there the longest, probably takes the most beating from early season cold, the early season snow like we had this year, to lots of rain, humidity.
40% of your total yield for the year.
Right.
I think the biggest key part is it's the highest yielding crop you typically right. out of the cuttings. So mm-hmm. it just, you're protecting more yield. And it does seem like those bottom leaves, you can get them to hold a little bit better underneath on that sort of, it's tall. It's the tallest of all the cuttings usually too, that when you get up to that 26, 28 inches.
Right. How many times does it lodge? And then, right. Right. And then you pull back and the stems are just very black. So I do agree with you, Todd. That is important. There's a couple of options to go with. I like Headline the best. Seems like it does best out of all of them. The Strobilurin and fungicides are kind of, that's what we're using. Uses a specific metabolic, if I can get that right this morning, pathway that limits the energy production of that fungus. So it kind of limits it that way.
Good old strobes.
That's right. But the problem with these guys is they're at a high risk for resistance. So if we can only, via the label, spray 3 times a year. But even at that, it's probably more than we need to do. So my customers are doing it once, if they're doing it at all, per year. And that's, again, just like we talked on first crop. So we got to watch that, too, that we're not abusing this. And all of a sudden, our good old strobes, as Matt, you just said, just aren't there. Did find some good research from UW. The headline, it had about a 0.1 dry matter tons over the untreated. So there is a benefit there. You probably have to do the math. That might not be, depending on the year.
Enough to pay for it.
But I've done stuff at work over the years, and I do think, like Todd, you said about holding those bottom leaves, I think you see a quality benefit just from those leaves that are still there. Like, we've done tests. It's not statistically replicated, but we've done side-by-sides and trials that way, and it's definitely, you get better results from spraying the fungicide, and then you look back at those plants, and you have 3 or 4 more sets of leaves on the bottom end of the plant. They're just still there, and that's got to help in quality.
Yeah, a lot of the research when this was done, and Matt, you helped out, when Brian Jensen,
yep, when we did those plots,
plot with shout out to, yeah, retired UW
entomologist
Brian Jensen. And yeah, he had the idea to do plots. We kind of found a grower and then we helped him harvest. So Brian would come out, map it out, spray it, and did fungicide and insecticide and untreated. It was just amazing walking them because the fungicide ones looked quite a bit better. And then the fungicide and insecticide, even that when you didn't really have much insect pressure, still looked better as well. And that was one of the frustrating parts is like by what your eyes showed you and then what the yield results or quality results showed wasn't always as good as you thought it would be. So it was kind of a bit of a tricky thing to watch because it just felt like it looks so much better. Those bottom leaves are there. And I don't know if a lot of those bottom leaves at harvest, you knock them off anyway. You know, they're kind of loosely on there. You just knock them off. So it didn't really matter. You maybe retained a few more leaves, but not enough for it to truly matter. But yeah, it was a good to do the research and to see how it was done and to see that one of the other frustrating parts is I think it was over a 3-year study and one of the years was a huge payback and really two of the other years were kind of not good payback. So it was also one of the biggest frustration parts of it was the inconsistency of knowing when to do it.
Well, I think the 1 year, the insecticide really helped because that was that 2012 year we had a lot of insects.
Those random
alfalfa.
Yeah, remember that?
We had variegated cutworm, yep. Army worm. Like
that was a bad year.
Yeah.
Everything that could possibly hatch seemed to hatch in the alfalfa fields.
Not going to lie, the way February and March went, I thought we were in for that again this year. Kind of. Oh, man, we might still be, but not
right.
as bad.
No, I think it is. I was kind of thinking the same thing walking the hayfields the other day of like, this is the year we're going to have to watch for insect pressure early, even in this first cutting, because normally it's after first crop. This is when you really have to worry about it. But
yeah, even this year, there is some weevil pressure out there. Right. I've heard down south, Nebraska, Missouri, just certain different states where they maybe do have alfalfa, they've had to spray for weevils. So
yeah,
just because, yeah, but it really didn't come to fruition to be real bad this year, which is good because we didn't need that.
I'd be curious to see if the fungicide concept catches on a little more with now we have this more of a Harvextra. If we get to a spot where more growers do extend that window of cutting.
Sure, it helps maintain.
Right, instead of cutting at 28 days or cutting at 35 or 40 days, whatever that is, and 40 might be a little long, but the study, Todd, you were a part of, that was like 2015-ish, right?
Right.
2012, yep. 2015. So, I mean, we really weren't thinking about extending cutting windows at that point.
No, and the ones that, because the research did show if your cutting window was, you know, in that 35-day range, like a real long window, that it did pay more often. But that was like a beef grower, like a, you know, somebody that wanted low-quality feed or lower quality. So it was like a different goal there. It wasn't a dairy producer for that. So like you say, now you might have a dairy producer with a low lignin that this might be a kind of an add-on to.
We're trying, I mean, the goal here is reduce disease, but also some of the benefits potentially could be improved stand counts, better winter survival, just a healthier plant, right? We're keeping that plant healthier longer. It's going to be able to withstand a lot of different adversity, whether that's wheel traffic, weather, whatever. And maybe that's something we can't measure.
Well, it was very hard to measure.
Right. All we can do is we can measure yield, but maybe in the end, those things we can't measure are helping
the
us.
The added value things that, are hard to quantify. And when it comes to, you know, did the hay wake up earlier the next year or did it just look healthier?
I do know that Brian Jensen tried to quantify that in this and in general. There was always this idea that you'd spray one cutting and is there advantages down line of that one spray?
Yeah.
So what this research was, you sprayed first cutting, then you went to yield of that. Well, then was there some sort of added benefit? And what it kind of showed is maybe there was, I know we had increased plant counts by a little bit. If you sprayed like third or fourth cut, then the next year you had potential, but it wasn't enough to be conclusive, though, that's for sure. And to say that that's why, or that you should add on these extra benefits, it was like, well, maybe there's a few extra things, but you really got to focus on that one. And one of the hardest parts I feel with this, with one of the frustrations I have with alfalfa and diseases, is we really can't scout for them. Not to say we can't scout and treat it, is most time by the time we find it, we're too late.
Yeah, fungicides are not curative, they're preventative.
Plus, all these, so looking through the book, all of these fungicides are a 14-day to cut product. So if we spray them, we got to wait 14 days till we cut it.
Most of the time, and you're a week out from cutting, and you're like, oh, there's the disease now. It wasn't here last week, it's here this week. Well,
for some reason, I find a lot of diseases 10 days out from cutting.
Yeah.
And so you go like, well, shoot. Or like in first cutting here, usually we're not hitting that window. It just doesn't seem like, you know, that the weather could be conducive to diseases, but it's hard to kind of pull that trigger. And it seems like by the time you want to pull that trigger, it's either too late, or like the disease is already there enough that it's just too late. So it is one of those tricky things where I do feel it's got to be in a management system and it's got to be planned out. We're going to do sort of this. I've even liked to look at different stand years of life and when do you aim at. Is like we said, first cut, we get a better stand life. Same with age of stand. So if it's a second year alfalfa stand, especially this year, they're just full of leaves, look really nice. Look
no dandelions.
Right.
Yeah.
So those might be your fields you want to protect and spray. Your third year fields probably fall in that category. And then fourth year, by that time, you're probably just better off taking, you know, whatever you get, and there's just a little less.
That's to protect. That's what we should have done. Looked at dandelion quality after.
Yes, maybe spraying. The dandelions were better. Yeah,
more tasty to the average bovine. Less
dandelion disease. You're right. You're just feeding the dandelions. Then that's a mistake.
I remember this like so fairly early in my career is when this really started. In the first few years, it was like all the questions of like, should I be doing this? What's going on? And that's why we're doing the research plots and all that. And now it kind of feels like one of those things. And not that fungicide in other crops isn't this way, but it's kind of either you do or you don't. There's not really a lot of middle ground. Like, oh, maybe this year I will. It seems to be it's a planned thing, like you said, Todd, and it's something we're going to do. We're going to look at it as, you know, hoping to get that bump and improving our stand.
Well, look at any other disease, right? Tar spot, some year, like we had a couple years that were really bad, and then the last couple haven't been so bad. You know, like northern corn leaf blight. Yep, same difference. If we were trying to grow alfalfa in southern Illinois,
I do think that might be a whole different.
Right. Maybe my problem is I do see a difference of like say the white mold. You get white mold in the soybean field, and it's like it reoccurs. The next time you have it, it's like, oh, that one gets white mold bad. We got to know that. Even tar spot seems to be a little bit that, obviously, once you have it in a spot, you know.
Well, and if it's corn on corn.
But if the residue is there, if it's...
Alfalfa, I don't necessarily see like, oh, this is really bad disease, and next year it's going to be really bad disease in that field.
No, not at all.
What I wish is, that, you know, like a Damon Smith at UW, who's created Tar Spotter and Sporecaster, like if we did have a way to predict with weather what diseases... You know, if we had a higher instance of disease out there, because I think going back to that research too, there was enough years where, I mean, the reason it didn't pay is there's no disease there. So, of course, it's not going to pay. So, if you can have a way to predict early enough, because like we just talked, you kind of got to be quite on the early side to be spraying it, you know, predict early enough that we could be out there going.
If you knew what the weather was going to be for the next 3 weeks, it'd be easy, right?
Right.
Too many options, too many unpredictable factors.
I think bottom line when we're talking about alfalfa fungicide is, like you said, Ted, it has to be in a management system. It's probably not going to pay every year. And potentially that 1 year it does pay is going to pay for the previous 5 years or whatever that number is. So if it works for you, you're probably going to keep doing it. If you aren't, well, then it probably just can't convince you that it's going to work too.
All right. Well, there you go. There's some considerations if you're thinking about adopting a fungicide program for your alfalfa. Now we'll move on to our spotlight for today. Today we're rolling right into another disease that we kind of touched on in the last segment here, tar spot. So Bayer has ramped up its tar spot research by using a new practice. So if you wonder how your cornbread or corn hybrids, not cornbread, cornbread is delicious, but corn hybrids can stand up to tar spot, you still have plenty of company across the country. Other corn growers are trying to learn the same thing as our seed corn companies. So the need for more information was a catalyst for Bayer crop science researchers on implementing in-company field test plots this season. They are artificially inoculating some of the company's existing hybrids and more than 100 pre-commercial hybrids with tar spot to evaluate how well the products tolerate the disease. We want them to understand tar spot better so we can deliver the best corn products to farmers and help them manage the disease more effectively in the fields, according to Jim Donnelly, a DeKalb technical agronomist based in northern Illinois. So the work will help researchers advance tar spot tolerance for DeKalb and channel corn products, according to the Bayer press release. So research is underway in three states, Illinois, Iowa, and Wisconsin. They will be inoculating the corn hybrids in one-acre plots in seven locations in those three states. And once they put the plot out with the inoculum present, they're hoping to grow the hybrids under heavy disease pressure. And then that way they'll have a better handle of what the tolerance really is rather than naturally waiting for tar spot to show up where, you know, we just talked about it.
It's the perfect segue into the hardest part about some of our research. I'd say insects is number one of how do you do a research plot when the insect, without inoculating it or introducing the insect into it. And disease is right there too of you do all the research you want, but if disease doesn't show up, then you didn't prove anything. And then weeds obviously is that way too, that there's always talk of like, oh, I'm going to, plant some of these weeds in the research. All of these things feel dirty to me. Like,
yeah,
like it just, this tar spot planting idea just feels wrong. But I do think
do you think they're just like, right, like dousing themselves in tar spot inoculum and rolling around
yes.
the field?
Yes, yes, I do.
Like, yes.
You just get like the tar spot brushes, the can of tar spot
spray.
They're
using actual tar, like roofing tar, right. And they're putting it just in. Like,
whipping it with
little spots. No, absolutely, it's hard to create those severe years in a vacuum. And so, they're hopefully going to find out this way how these hybrids are managing. They have said that so far in their research, it seems that hybrids that are fairly tolerant to the disease still benefit from a fungicide application to help protect against yield loss. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they'll be able to breed tolerance such to the point that, at least in the short term, that it'll be able to resist the disease completely, but at least hopefully mitigate some of the issues they have. So be interesting to follow and see where that goes. Now we'll move into our Ag History Minute. All right, today we're talking origins of the U.S. Drought Monitor. The U.S. Drought Monitor is a map that is updated each Thursday to show the location and intensity of drought across the country. The USDM uses a five-category system labeled abnormally dry or D0, precursor to drought, not actual drought, moderate D1, severe D2, extreme D3, and exceptional D4 drought. Drought categories show experts' assessments of conditions related to dryness and drought, including observations of how much water is available in streams, lakes, and soils compared to usual for the same time of year. The U.S. Drought Monitor began in 2000 and is a collaboration between the NDMC, NOAA, and the USDA, that's a lot of acronyms right there, who share the weekly author role for the product. The NDMC, based at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, leads the coordination of weekly drought monitor process and provides maps, data, and statistics to the public. So where does all the information come from? Each week, drought experts consider how recent precipitation totals across the country compare to long-term averages. They check variables including temperature, soil moisture, water levels in streams and lakes, snow cover, and meltwater runoff. Experts also check whether areas are showing drought impacts, such as water shortages and business interruptions. Based on dozens of indicators, experts make their best judgments of regional scale drought conditions, then check their assessments with experts in the field before publishing weekly drought maps. Associated statistics show what proportion of various geographic areas that are in each category of dryness or drought and how many people are affected. So, sounds like a lot of work goes into the drought monitor. And again, you know, we've talked about on this episode, past episodes, you know, rainfall can be spotty. So the drought monitor isn't necessarily perfect, but it gives you a good snapshot of kind of what different areas seem to be experiencing throughout the season. So there you go.
They do got a lot of, on their website, a lot of cool other maps to show. Because obviously it's drought of dry, but it just says, you know, there's just basically a zero. It doesn't say the other side, a wet. They do have a crop moisture index map that shows kind of like...
Yeah, there's...
Severely dry to excessively wet or abnormally moist. That's my favorite category.
Yeah, there's a number of resources because I think what was one of the Badger Crop Connects they talked about, the soil moisture measurements that they have. And that was a good indicator, like we were talking about earlier, of yes, it seems like it's wetter. You know, we're getting more rainfall now, but soil moisture levels, at least early in the season, were still below what they would normally be at. And so now, moving forward, it'll be interesting to watch that metric and see if our soil moisture is raised and we keep getting rain, then, you know, we'll know we're closer to that dreaded word that I don't like to use too often, normal. Because I don't know what normal is. I'm certainly not normal.
Typical
is what I try to use more often, yes.
Typical.
So, typical, Bill.
All right, thank you, Matt, and thank you to all listeners out there. Please subscribe to the podcast and tell a farmer friend. It's really easy. Just search Tilt Talk Radio in Apple Podcasts. Or on an Android phone, you need to download an app like Podcast Addict, and then you search Tilt Talk Radio on that app, and you can subscribe right there. It's really easy to listen on your computer or smartphone browser. Go to tilthegg.com/podcasts, and you can follow us on Facebook and X at Tilt Talk Radio.
All right. Thanks, Todd. Now we'll move into our Cool Beans. That's Corny and some current events. So Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans.
Cool Beans. Our Cool Beans this week. Florida has become the first state to ban the sale of lab-grown meat. The first bill banning lab-grown meat was signed into law by Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida on May 1st. According to SB 1084, the bill prohibits the manufacture for sale, the sale, holding, or offering for sale of or distribution of cultivated meat in the state. So in press conference in Hardy County. I think that's where Hardy started, the restaurant.
Really?
I don't know. It'd be really cool if it was.
It was. They probably used lab meat back in the day.
Which is one of the top five cattle-producing counties in the state. Governor spoke about the importance of supporting rural economies and agriculture. So he said, we are fighting back against an ideology that ultimately wants to eliminate meat production in the U.S. and around the globe. The state of Florida, we've put down the marker very clearly. We stand with agriculture, stand with cattle ranchers, stand with our farmers, because we understand it's important for the backbone of the state. It's important for our culture. It's important for our heritage, so that the bill I'm going to sign today is going to say, basically, you take your fake lab-grown meat elsewhere. We're not doing that in the state of Florida. direct quote there by Ron DeSantis.
Take it to a different state.
So get your lab meat. Take your lab grown meat and you get the heck out of here.
The stock photo on here, the lab meat, just makes me like throw up in my mouth.
It yeah, it's gross.
This is weird.
It's probably actual meat, like it cut into a circle and put in a petri dish.
That, yeah, it's weird.
It's good for Florida. I wouldn't have expected Florida to be the one to ban it first.
Right, because you don't really, I don't
Texas,
think
of my money would have been on Texas right, for sure.
Cattle production as Florida.
Texas all the way, yeah.
Or like the ranchers like Wyoming or Colorado or somewhere like that.
But yeah, so there's been ongoing debate across the country in regard to cultivated meat products. Currently, lab-grown meat is only approved to be sold in the U.S. and Singapore. Italy was the first country in the EU to ban lab-grown meat, which was the decision made this past February. So I'm sure we'll be hearing more about this in the future. Our That's Corny this week. Our friends down in Nebraska and Iowa had to put planting on hold due to some storms that raced through their states. So the end of April, early May brought some pretty nasty stuff down through those states, and they had to kind of hold off from planting in Iowa. The farmer Kelly Garrett farms 4,000 acres of corn, 1,800 acres of soybeans, and 170 acres of winter wheat. So the bad storms that went through Iowa. Never seen devastation like that firsthand, he said. Pictures don't even begin to describe how bad things were. Extremely heartwarming to see all the people show up and help all those people recover from the storms. But yeah, unfortunately, those types of things tend to cause a lot of issues with, just garbage in the fields when you get winds and tornadoes and all that kind of stuff.
Well, the little one that hit Tilth World headquarters a handful of years ago, the amount of garbage that threw around, I can't imagine like the pictures we were seeing from like Nebraska and Iowa, like the little video almost, it looked like a movie.
Like Twister style.
Yeah, the Twister style. Like so perfect. The tornadoes were so perfect and just, they're neat to watch. Obviously, it's terrible what they're doing, but I can't imagine like when you have whole cities that just get tore up like these pictures in this article is showing like how much trash and just garbage and steel and metal and everything everywhere.
Yeah, and it's even though I'm sure they're able to carry on and plant and stuff this year, they'll be dealing with the aftermath for a while because there'll be things that they'll pull up or they get buried or they'll have to plant around this year that will impact the future years too. So it's always unfortunate, and hopefully this year doesn't turn out to be a major year for that kind of thing across the country. But
after experiencing it, like you say, Bill, like somewhat secondhand, but I mean, we're still cleaning up from it, so it's just it's a multi-year process, and you just hope that everybody involved, in general, it sounded like people were safe, which was good, so that was good, and hopefully now they can, it's just hard when you're planting and cleaning up all at the same time, but yeah.
All right, and our Field Good Friday this week, Green Bay Packers fifth round draft pick, Jacob Monk, has asked for cheese recommendations. And fans were more than happy to help. So he asked what might be the best question for any
That's a simple, new Packer to perfect ask. Question.
Where can I get the best cheese? And so a lot of people threw out anything from cheese heads. There's a picture of a guy who posted a picture of that. Cheese curds. Curds at Kroll's specifically. Being in Green Bay, that would be a nice local option for him. Best cheese curds are at Cheese Curds Wisconsin. Definitely worth the drive. Fresh is best. Can't disagree there. Love fresh cheese curds. Carr Valley Cheese Curds, Renard's Cheese were among the ones listed. Cedar Valley, Sartori, just lots of different options out there. Henning's Cheese was thrown out as an option, so doesn't really matter what your favorite is, as long as you have access to it and can get the squeaky curds, if that's your deal, or deep-fried cheese curds are good too. Have you guys ever had the eaten the block fresh cheddar cheese? So it's like a giant cheese curd, but in a square or like rectangle.
Baby cheddar, baby Swiss, those right. kind of, yeah.
Yeah, that kind of thing.
Very good.
Yeah. It's like the next best thing to cheese curds. So
remember our old quarterback that like didn't drink dairy and was
that one New York, the new New York bozo?
Yeah.
That guy?
That guy.
The one who
played four plays last year.
Right.
Okay. Right.
Who all he has to do is get one more down to surpass his record in New York. No, it'll be interesting to see if Jordan Love and other Packers, we have a very young team. There's not a lot of guys that have been here for a while. If they embrace the cheese or...
Seems like they are embracing the cheese, yep.
Well, Jacob Monk is, he's...
Yes, I like that.
He's asking
That's a pretty cheese. Boss move for just coming into the state like, okay, bring it to me, I want it.
Well, and, you know, they always, there's always that been that, you know, message of like, oh, nobody wants to play in Green Bay. Here, this guy's coming right out and like, hey, get me some cheese. Embrace the culture. Embrace the agriculture. Yeah. No, so it's good to see. Hopefully he'll be a good player for the Packers and hang around for quite some time.
He's going to have healthy bones.
Yes, he will. Maybe he can get some chocolate milk to recover after games, too. But that'll do it for this week. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thanks for having us, Matt.
So this week we talked about fungicide and alfalfa and some considerations if you're considering that for the future. Maybe too late for this year, but something to consider going into next year's alfalfa stands. In our spotlight, we took a look at some research going on with tar spot. Ag History Minute, we talked the origins of the drought monitor. Cool beans this week, Florida has banned the sale of lab-grown meat. That's corny, was early storms that held back few states in their planting progress. Our Field Good Friday was new draft pick Jacob Monk asking for cheese recommendations for his journey here in Wisconsin. So thanks for listening, and as always, happy farming.